From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Calling all avid readers, accomplished writers, or those aspiring to be, we talk with the director of the City Lit Festival, Carla Dupre, about tomorrow's highlights and hear about her goal for the day-long event.
We want to bring enough voices to the table to say, you know what, there's something that resonates for you. I was in sixth grade before I realized that there was a story out there about me. And I don't want people to have that experience where they have to wait till they're 11, 12, and 13 years old. We want that experience now.
And we meet podcaster Eliza Romero to hear her thoughts on changes to required high school reading, plus a sweet bit of the history of Baltimore skyline, all on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Are you interested in writing tips from an award-winning screenwriter? Or perhaps help in finding your literary voice? What about engaging in some real talk about journalism in the age of Trump? You can find all that and much more at the 16th Annual City Lit Festival tomorrow from 9:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the William H. Thummel Senior Business Center at the University of Baltimore. The free event brings together new and established writers for readings, workshops, panel discussions, and one-on-one sessions. Here to tell us more about it is City Lit Project Director Carla Dupre. Dupre is also a fiction writer and chair of the Maryland State Arts Council's Diversity Outreach Committee. Welcome back to On the Record, Carla.
Thank you for having me, Sheila.
Also with us is Eliza Romero, founder, blogger, and podcast host of Aesthetic Distance. She'll be moderating a panel titled, Your Classics Aren't My Classics, Decolonizing the Literary Canon for Asian Americans. Welcome to the show, Eliza.
Good morning.
Carla Dupre, Danny Shapiro is the festival keynote speaker. Tell us about Danny Shapiro.
I first learned about her work when she wrote a book called Still Writing. It appeals to just the creative life of a writer or really any artist. I've been following her ever since. Her latest work, Inheritance, is about her discovery of who she belongs to. And she takes us through every bit of her feelings about discovering her biological father. And it reads like a thriller. It reads like something you yourself are experiencing. I think it'll resonate with a lot of people just about the idea of trying to figure out who you belong to. I think that particular story resonates with anyone who's trying to discover their roots.
So Danny Shapiro is a keynote speaker because of what is the connection to City Lit?
The connection is that we're living in a place at a time when discovering voices, discovering, unpacking your life is a pretty big deal with Ancestry.com. I don't know if any of you have known, but I think African Americans especially, when you start investigating who your ancestors, it's a pretty complicated experience, but also one where you learn a little bit about family secrets. So I thought that particular message would resonate with a lot of people, and apparently it has, because we're getting a lot of calls about people wanting to attend the event simply because they have a message similar to hers, and they've been wrestling with just that, you know, the complicated idea of unpacking your family history. And I think Danny Shapiro will bring that to the City Lit Festival.
What are some of the other festival highlights? And I know that's a little bit like asking you to pick among your children.
It really is asking, because I'm so excited about the number of voices we have coming to the table. We have a lot of young poets, we have emerging poets, established poets. But a couple that I'd like to bring to light is we have a master class with Kia Cawthorn. She's from Maryland, she's a Cumberland resident, and she's an award-winning playwright. She's coming to talk about dialogue and how to increase tension in dialogue and how to make it seem authentic. She'll talk about dialect and whether or not it's, you know, appropriated the right kind of way. We have one-on-one critique sessions with incredible editors who want to be there. For 30 minutes, you get to sit down with an editor to talk specifically about your work.
You've done those kinds of critique sessions before,
yes.
And there's a huge appetite for it.
Appetite for it, and the fact that the editors want to do it. They keep coming back saying, okay, we got something out of this too. So it makes it an added value. We're also excited about two writers who are coming in, Akiba Solomon and Kendra Rankin, to talk about their new collection called How We Fight White Supremacy. It's a field guide to Black resistance, and we think they will bring an incredible conversation to Baltimore in particular, because it's such an open, wide conversation about how you discover making a space for yourself, how you talk about those really uncomfortable conversations and make room for that conversation. We have Angie Kim with her debut book, Miracle Creek, once again about family secrets and discovering different therapies for autism. We have sessions that appeal to writers. For instance, how to structure a novel. We have five novelists coming who will talk about how they structure novels, how it can be very different, and they're providing handouts. So it's almost like you're walking away with this process of how to do these things. We have a panel of immigrant voices called No One Leaves Home Unless Home is the Mouth of a Shark. That's a Worsaae Shire quote. It appealed to writers who have roots from all over the world, who will talk about their experiences in America, either feeling displaced or feeling connected some kind of way. We're going to be talking, reintroducing children's literature to City Lit. Well, in the past, we've had children's authors. This year, we're bringing an incredible panel of esteemed authors. Sharon G. Flake, come on. Tiffany Jackson. These are award-winning writers who have won every kind of award you can have for children's literature. We have debut authors like Andrew Simonette, who's currently the founder of Artist U. He's coming with his book, Wilder. We have Susan Mulati Jaraj, who will be talking about her middle grade series, which is forthcoming next year, called Farrah Rocks. It's the first time there's been a Palestinian-American middle grade series, which is unheard of, right? We want it so these things aren't unheard of. We want to bring enough voices to the table to say, you know what, there's something that resonates for you. I was in sixth grade before I realized that there was a story out there about me. And I don't want people to have that experience where they have to wait till they're 11, 12, and 13 years old. We want that experience now. We appeal to readers and we appeal to writers. We want them in the room. And we're also telling writers, you know, get out of your lane. If you're a poet, go listen to novelists and how they do their work. We're also, just so you know, and I have to say this, we have funders in the room who talk about how to get funded, how to get grants.
The money aspect.
Yes, the money is really important. Money is important because, one, writers generally don't think this is for them. I can't tell you how many times I've heard writers say, oh, I thought about it. Don't think about it. The representatives are in the room, and they're from all over. They're from all over because they want people to know about them. That's the Maryland State Arts Council. That's NEA. That's Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance. That's Robert W. Deutsch Foundation. And we have a person who actually received a grant to talk about what happens with her experience of actually applying and getting it.
I can see why you're very excited about this lineup. Eliza, before we talk about the panel that you are moderating, tell us about your blog and podcast, Aesthetic Distance. What is it?
We started out talking about mostly pop culture, but from a Filipino-American lens. And we're starting to talk more and more about Filipino politics, Filipino-American identity, race relations in the United States. I blog a lot about the entertainment industry and Filipino Americans and Asian Americans' place in it. Pretty much no topic is out of bounds. We talk about everything. And I always have a new guest every week on my podcast, and it's almost always someone Asian American.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Carla Dupre, director of the City Lit Project, and Eliza Romero, founder, blogger, and podcast host of Aesthetic Distance. We're talking about the City Lit Festival all day tomorrow at UB, Mount Royal Avenue, and Charles Street. So this intriguing title for the panel you're moderating, Your Classics Aren't My Classics, Decolonizing the Literary Canon for Asian Americans. Tell us about this panel. Who's on it?
My panelists include Makita Rivas, who is a Mexican and Filipino writer. She's a freelance journalist for Teen Vogue, Refinery 29, and The Washington Post. I also have Chris Jesu Lee, who is Korean-American and the editor-in-chief for Plan A magazine, which is a Pan-Asian-American online publication and a weekly podcast. Jem Douse is a professor of Filipino-American studies at University of Maryland College Park. His classes are interdisciplinary and they emphasize public policy as it intersects with community building and identity. I've got Marisa Rodriguez, who is a Filipino-American scholar at American University, where she is studying indigenous and ethnic identity. Sharon Tran is a Vietnamese-American and also an assistant professor of English literature at University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Her research focuses on multi-ethnic American and Asian American literature with an emphasis on gender studies. And last but not least is Fran Del Rosario, who is a bookstagrammer, and her reading preferences lean towards immigrant narratives, focusing on loss, displacement, and transformation.
Wow, that's a lineup in itself. What do you hope comes from this discussion?
I would really like my attendees to come away with an understanding of why there have hardly been any Asian American stories in literature, and I want them to understand their own power as consumers of books and literature. And if there's any educators in the audience, I want them to understand the importance of assigning more Asian American nonfiction and fiction works to their students, not just at the college level, at the elementary school, middle school, and high school levels.
Interesting point. Both of you, do you think schools have broadened diversity in required reading in the last decade? Do you see any change?
I would say there's some progress, but probably not enough. But it is something I plan on asking the educators on my panel. I'm hoping that they can provide some insight and some answers for everyone in our audience and have them thinking about it moving forward.
I can say this. Last fall, we introduced, we meaning a group partnership, introduced One Baltimore Book Project, where all the middle grade, eighth grade students read the same book, Nick Stone's book. And it was revelatory. I mean, you have teachers, students, communities invested in reading one book. But that engages people in the art of reading stories that resonate in the lives of those children and those communities. So we're all for it. And because we need diverse books, efforts like that, you see more and more writers of color actually writing elementary school books. We see more publishers wanting to hear those different voices. Because here's the thing, it's a story. It resonates with more than just that child of color. It resonates with everyone. So why not have different voices come to the table?
Well, yeah, I mean, that raises the question of, do you think that the definition of diversity has changed when it comes to literature? Are educators thinking more broadly about what it means to be diverse?
First, I really don't like that word diverse. I think there should be another word for it because it's almost overused. It kind of waters it down and reduces it.
I think it makes it seem almost inessential.
Yes. And I think,
so what would be a better word?
Normal?
Normal.
Wouldn't that be an interesting thing that it's normal to see your face in a picture book?
Mm-hmm.
Or your culture represented widely so you don't have to discover it outside of a classroom only. And right now, that's what our children are discovering outside of the classroom, from their parents, their family, their libraries. We want schools to get it.
How does something like the City Lit Festival, one day, one intense day, move what you're picking up outside school into the way educators think?
City Lit's mission is to create enthusiasm for literature. And if you were to look at the pictures of all the writers coming, they look like the world. They do. And it's so important for those voices to show up. And we have many emerging writers that are coming who don't declare themselves writers yet because they don't see enough of it. And what we're telling them is, this festival is to empower you to write that story, because it will resonate with someone. This festival is to let you know that your voice, your stories do matter to the literary canon. And that includes Asian Americans, because they're featured in almost every session that we have. That includes conversations that are challenging. Mass incarceration. Chris Wilson.
The Master Plan.
The Master Plan is a game changer as it comes to how we deal with those who are recently incarcerated, how we deal with the criminal justice system, period. He is one of those artists that you just want, you see him just taking off. And this is a person who suffered pretty much as a youngster, but he grew out of it. Grew out of it in a way that he taught himself different things. And he's taking his gifts and showing it to the world.
Thank you both for this conversation. Have fun tomorrow.
We sure will. Thank you, Sheila.
Thanks for having us.
Carla Dupre is director of the City Lit Project. Eliza Romero, blogger and podcast host, will moderate a panel titled Your Classics Aren't My Classics, Decolonizing the Literary Canon for Asian Americans at the 16th Annual City Lit Festival tomorrow. The one-day literary arts event happens from 9:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the William H. Thummel Senior Business Center at the University of Baltimore, 11 West Mount Royal Avenue in Baltimore. We have a link to more information at the On the Record page at WIPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Short break and then a sweet bit of the history of Baltimore skyline. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Here's On the Record producer Melissa Gear with a story that originally aired on WYPR's The Signal about what gives Baltimore's Domino Sugar sign that sweet glow. It was placed 68 years ago this week.
Each day, I commute back into Baltimore coming off of I-95, and the Domino's Sugar sign plays peekaboo with me through openings in the slabs of concrete overpass. It disappears and reappears behind buildings and smokestacks as I wind my way into the city. And each day, it's kind of like a game. I try to catch a good, clear glimpse of it. Daytime or night, the enormous letters swirl and slant in the distance like this gorgeous urban sculpture. It's a signal that I'm home, and it's a distinct marker in the harbor of an adopted city I've come to love. And I'm not alone in my little obsession, I've learned. People in Baltimore love this sign.
We're getting married in 2 months, and our reception's going to be at the Baltimore Museum of Industry, and we picked that because the Domino Sugar sign will illuminate the dance floor.
I take 295 to 95, and on the ramp, I always see the big Domino Sugar sign. It just reminds me of old Baltimore, kind of like an old friend.
So when we were looking to buy a new home in Baltimore City, without that being an original intention, it became a criteria that the Domino Sugar sign be a view from our new house. And now every night before I go to bed, I see the red Domino Sugar sign from my window. And it's a sweet reminder that I'm in Baltimore City.
I started poking around about it and was actually quite excited to discover that this month is the 62nd anniversary of the Domino Sugar sign. It was installed on April 25th, 1951. A day on which I imagine there had to be some huge party, maybe a band or fireworks or who knows what else. It must have been a big deal when this giant neon glow would beam out onto the harbor for the very first time. So to get some historical perspective, I contacted the best person I could think of.
Not to be a flipper impertinent, please, but you don't know better. You really don't know.
Gilbert Sandler, Oracle of all things Baltimore.
You haven't seen anything. You weren't here in the 80s when we did Harbor Place and the Renaissance just wafted through like some magic perfume that we all breathed in. You weren't here, so you think the sign is a game changer. It wasn't.
He was kind about it, but I still felt a little deflated.
Why would they have done a big thing for a sign? We didn't do that. Nobody ever asked me at the sign, go cover that sign or putting a sign up. I never remember that. Ribbon cuttings, all that came. We didn't cover ribbon cuttings. Take an ad.
During our conversation, I actually found myself defending the significance of a neon sign. I wanted my fantasy of that day to be real.
I just don't remember any celebration when it went up. The celebration is that it's still up. That's the celebration. Something hasn't changed in a changing city. That's worthwhile celebrating, that sign is still there after 62 years. It's an important icon because it's part of what a Baltimorean defines, whether he knows it or not. It's this sense of place.
I wasn't interested in proving Sandler wrong so much as I wanted to do right by our sign. Because like Sandler said, it's an icon and it's part of what defines our sense of Baltimore. So how was there no big to-do when a giant 120 by 70-foot neon sign goes up in the harbor? But all I found, after searching historical photos and scouring every month, January through December 1951, in the Baltimore Sun archives, was this tiny notice that was actually more like a classified ad detailing the city council's business that day.
February 18th, 1951, Council Proceedings number 2605. To permit the American Sugar Refining Company to increase the size of an illuminated sign on the roof of the Domino Building.
That was it. Seriously. I tried another route. I contacted Artcraft Strauss, a company in New York that designed and built the sign.
Hi, this is Arthur Baum at Artcraft Strauss, returning your call. I got your message. I don't know what information you require about the Domino sign. I did a little preliminary checking, and alas, we really have virtually no information on it whatsoever. We don't even have a project file for it, which is a file that would be that would contain information about the construction of the sign and so on. If you still need to talk to me, please call me back.
Yeah, I did call him back, and by that time, he had even checked their archives at the New York Public Library. Nothing. But this was the installation of the second largest neon sign on the East Coast. How was there nothing? Business as usual, Arthur explained, would just not have been documented. I was convinced something about this sign was bigger and brighter than business as usual. So I went to the epicenter to try to find out more.
And this tall white stack that everybody sees from the harbor is where we generate power. They have a 14 megawatt power plant on site. We're burning natural gas and producing steam and electricity to run the plant.
Stu Fitzgibbon is the Domino Sugar Plant Manager. He's been with Domino 32 years. In the three-hour tour, we saw the refining, processing, and packaging of millions of pounds of sugar. It's like a small city inside. There are about 600 people that work there. Everyone I encountered, whether I had a microphone pointed toward them or not, managed to work into the conversation how much the Domino plant felt like family. That loyalty, they were quick to add, went both ways. And that was an unexpected surprise. Their love for Domino was palpable. Toward the end of the plant tour, Fitzgibbon and I walked up to the top of the building and went out the door leading to the roof landing. We had a stunning view of downtown, and the inner harbor stretched out 9 stories below us. As we stood underneath Baltimore's beacon of giant letters, neon tubes, and transformers, I asked him what significance the Domino sign held for him. Oddly, he began to recount the explosion at Domino in 2007. The plant had experienced complete power failure. The 6 o'clock news had reported a huge disaster, and the helicopters were still circling. They had just put out the fires inside and were taking stock of what they could power back up and what they couldn't. And because he was the plant manager, they put the question to him. You can do one of 3 things. You can turn on the refinery, you can turn on the packaging department, or you can turn on the sign.
And there was a state of disbelief when I told them to turn the sign on because they couldn't understand why I would want to make product. We couldn't do both. And I said, no, we need to tell the public that we're still running. And we put the sign on and it was all over the 11 o'clock news. So I think it was the right decision, and it was the right decision for the employees, because when that light came back on, the people that weren't at work, I'm going to start crying. the people who weren't at work knew that they would still have a place to work. Sorry. It's a little emotional for me. So that's what the sign means to me.
Did I imagine that a neon sign the size of a basketball court could be installed 62 years ago without any fanfare? No, that didn't make sense to me. Did I imagine I'd be standing underneath the same sign, hearing a plant manager tell a story about the people that work there with tears in his eyes? Nope, but that does make sense to me now, because the trip to the plant crystallized for me why Baltimore feels such affection for the Domino Sugar sign. It's not so much about what the sign was, but what it's become. And like Fitzgibbon said, the sign really represents all the people who work beneath it. While its bright neon glow comes directly from the energy the plant creates, The people inside create that energy. So the sign, just like Baltimore really, is all about the people. That energy, by way of 150 transformers and 6,300 feet of neon tubing, radiates its sweetness out all over Baltimore, saying, just like the packaging claims, we'll always be your sugar. Thanks, Domino, for 62 years of that sweet topping you bring to the Baltimore skyline, and I hope for many more years to come.
That was On the Record producer Melissa Gear telling the story behind the iconic Domino Sugar sign that lights up Baltimore's Inner Harbor. Yesterday was the 68th anniversary of putting the sign in its lofty place. Some other notable Baltimore anniversaries coming up, the Baltimore Youth Kinetic Energy Collective, BIKE, celebrates 5 years this weekend with an event at its workspace at 403 East Oliver Street tomorrow, Saturday, from 4 to 8 p.m. And you can celebrate 2 years of Sagamore Spirit Distillery tomorrow, beginning at 12 noon at 301 East Cromwell Street. Next Saturday is the American Visionary Art Museum's 21st annual Kinetic Sculpture Race. It launches at 10 a.m. from AVAM at 800 Key Highway. Then that evening, you can dance the night away at Strong City Baltimore's 50th anniversary party, Get On Up. So many events to celebrate the good that's happening in Baltimore. We have details at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening. Have a sweet weekend.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks!